It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. On Capitol Hill, the House voted Thursday to pass a budget rescission bill that would cut the $1.1 billion it set aside for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, over the next 2 years. That bill now goes to the Senate.
The CPB was created by Congress in 1967. It is a publicly funded nonprofit corporation that oversees federal grants to over 1,200 public radio stations like Wisconsin Public Radio and more than 300 public television stations like PBS Wisconsin.
PBS Wisconsin and WPR are services of UW-Madison's Division of Public Media and the Educational Communications Board, an independent state agency.
According to a statement yesterday evening, PBS Wisconsin and WPR together received about $5.7 million in CPB funding for the federal fiscal year 2025. We learned that represents just over 10% of the overall budget. Specifically, WPR's portion from the CPB amounts to about 6% of its revenue. David Folkenflik is following this issue closely. He is the media correspondent for NPR. David, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Can you walk us through the mechanics of how a rescission bill like this is actually working? What happens to the money that was budgeted for the CPB?
Sure. This hasn't been done in a generation. What happens is a president sends a request, a formal request to Congress, and that then Congress has 45 work days to affirmatively pass what the president is requesting. And this is taking back money that has already been approved by Congress. In this case, in this sort of overall catch-up spending act that was passed early this spring, both Republican-led houses of Congress passed funding for public broadcasting for the next two fiscal years, that is through the end of September 2027. And funding for public media is done and has been for decades in advance as an effort explicitly under law to insulate it from political pressures from any federal officials, which is an interesting irony given what we're talking about. So the House has passed that in this case. The president asked for over $9 billion to be rescinded. That is $8 point something billion for foreign aid and $1.1 billion for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, most of which, as your listeners may know, is distributed to local public television, public radio stations around the country. And now this goes to the Senate. The Senate has to affirmatively vote to pass this with the same language within 45 days for it by, I believe it's July 18th, according to parliamentarians, for this to take effect.
Okay, then so how does the funding model flow from the CPB to NPR and then down to member stations? Or what does that cascade look like?
To be honest, it sounds like it goes that way, but it mostly doesn't. What happens is they keep a little bit of money for administration in Washington, and then they distribute most of it, overwhelming majority of it, as I said, to public media stations, that is public television, public radio. 75% of it goes to television. A quarter of it goes to radio. Radio was a little bit of an afterthought in the drafting of this legislation. And it's also far less expensive than television. On average, PBS and local TV stations receive about 16% of their budgets from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Again, it's a privately incorporated institution under District of Columbia law, but it was chartered by Congress, as you said, and the federal money does flow through it. On average, approximately 10% of revenues for local radio stations, public radio stations, comes from that same federal taxpayer dollars. And NPR directly only gets roughly 1% each year. But both PBS and NPR get money back from stations for programming fees. So there is some indirect federal funding coming back up through the system from the local stations.
Local stations have been trying to reach constituents, have been trying to talk with lawmakers, have been reaching out to listeners and viewers. But, you know, conservatives have been trying to sever this federal funding grants for decades now. What is different about this moment?
Right. I mean, if you look at this, this was this legislation was passed under LBJ as part of the Great Society. But Richard Nixon was in office when PBS and NPR sprang to life. And he was somebody deeply distrustful, legendarily distrustful and hostile towards the press, which played a role in, of course, exposing the Watergate scandal and some of his other controversial and at times illegal activities under his administration. And there were efforts even in that time, although he did not sign off on them, to try to take away this nascent public radio, public television system. Under the Reagan years, there were efforts. You know, I covered Congress when Newt Gingrich was Speaker. He had brought a wave to of Republicans to power in 1995, and they made it an issue then, and it really intensified under the Tea Party. But it seemed to me back when I was a political reporter that this was something Republicans wanted as an issue rather than as a win. You know, President Trump has placed the media so squarely among his targets for his rhetoric, but also in the second term, really for his actions. Private lawsuits he filed as a private citizen, yes, against CBS and ABC, from which he's gotten one settlement and appears poised to get a second one. His chief broadcast regulator has gone off after every major broadcast network, including NPR and PBS, for investigations, except that owned by Trump's ally Rupert Murdoch, the Fox broadcast network. And you've seen, you know, just a number of efforts to go after media. Well, public media is, you know, one over which the federal government has a lot of influence because of this budgetary tie. And conservatives have argued for decades from the outset, but increasingly in recent years, that somehow that the coverage and programming choices made by NPR and PBS are untethered from the way most Americans experience their lives. And it is biased towards the left. They'll point to, you know, any item of the day, whether it's a coverage of the Israel-Hamas conflict to coverage of domestic politics, to say that it's unbalanced. I will tell you that, you know, journalists working for those outlets and the chief executives of those outlets by and large reject those claims while acknowledging misjudgments or mistakes or stories that didn't land right, or maybe the volume of stories that didn't land perfectly, that they're doing their best to fairly reflect a diverse and growing and polarized nation.
We have NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik with us as we talk about federal cuts pending to public media funding. David, NPR is currently suing the Trump administration over an executive order that sought to stop funding for NPR and PBS. Would this rescission bill circumvent that litigation? What happens?
So Trump issued an executive order to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting saying essentially you've got to stop all funding for NPR and PBS, and that all local public media outlets have to stop sending their funds to the big networks as well. What happens, the Corporation Public Broadcasting basically treated it as though, you know, somebody who runs a local franchise of Pizza Hut down the street had sent the same order. They said the president doesn't have the authority to do it. They're not suing him over it, but NPR is. It wants to ensure that there's some sort of judicial record saying the president doesn't have the authority to meddle in a privately incorporated entity's decisions. And in fact, there are statutory protections all over legislation involving public media saying that no federal official can interfere with public media on, you know, because they are upset about content, and news coverage very much falls into that category. And the Trump administration has clearly signaled from the president on down that he doesn't like the news coverage, really, from NPR and PBS. And that would seem to fall under that protection. NPR wants federal courts to say so and to sort of draw a line and prevent the administration from going further.
Okay, so this passes the House on a very thin margin. What are the prospects for this bill in the Senate?
Well, I got to say, it was fascinating to watch it yesterday in the House. It was won by a two-vote margin. Two Republican lawmakers pretty much at the very end, pretty much after time elapsed, switched their votes to make sure they got over the line. And it appears as though and the final vote, I believe, was cast by Mike Lawler, a Republican from the suburbs of New York. He and one of the two members who switched his vote, you know, have been very upset with the way in which property taxes have been disallowed as a deduction for high-income earners in the New York City suburbs. And, you know, that's been something they've said that they would need support on. So we don't know what they won for their votes, but it appears as though, you know, certainly they were pivotal to that passing. Similarly, in the United States Senate, you know, supporters of public media would have to win 4 Republican votes if Democrats were to all vote in favor. And of course, the Democrats would also have to all show up. There were several members of the Democratic side in the House who didn't yesterday, as well as 3 who have died in this brief tenure in Congress just since they took office in January. In the Senate, you also have elections coming up next year. You look at a couple of figures who might be sympathetic dispositionally, but also look at their constituents. You look at Tom Tillis of North Carolina, sort of mainstream Republican in a state with a Democratic governor, which was hard hit by a hurricane, where Blue Ridge Public Radio really served an amazing service at that time, at that crisis for that western part of North Carolina. You have Susan Collins in Maine, where Maine Public Broadcasting really helps to knit together a state which is really quite rural, mm-hmm. and where, you know, newspapers are struggling to keep heads above water. And she has said she has concerns about the foreign aid part of the bill. The only Republican who's put her head up above the parapet to say she would not support getting rid of funding for public media so far is Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. Mm-hmm. You know, her fellow Alaskan Senator Dan Sullivan, also Republican, is up for re-election next year. And Alaska really does depend its tribal audiences. Inuit audiences, you know, rural audiences really do rely on public radio, as they do other forms of federal largesse. But there's no clear path at the moment to knowing whether or not that sort of vote would be won.
In just about 10, 15 seconds, is this a crisis moment for local stations?
I think local stations would be hurt even more than public radio and public television, the network level. It'd be very hard, but I think that even if this were to hit just the stations, that would also help to really undermine the system and shake it. This is a pivotal moment for public media, whether you support or oppose the federal funding currently being provided for it.
David, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your time.
You bet.
David Fulkenflik is NPR's media correspondent with us to share the latest on the rescission bill in Congress that would cut the next 2 years of funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB provides important funding for NPR, PBS, and affiliates like WPR and PBS Wisconsin. And to note, WPR senior leaders had no input on this story.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, hundreds of lake districts operate around the state. These units of government work to protect water quality, promote boating safety, and restore habitat.
It's not to say that, you know, there's always 100% agreement, but I think we have a lot of good dialogue.
Hear from lake districts in Hayward and Marquesan. That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The swimming and boating season is underway in Wisconsin, and people with lakeside homes and vacation spots keep a close eye on the well-being of their local lakes.
Some communities go a step further to form what are called lake districts. These allow property owners to oversee pollution sources, ordinance changes, and other issues on the lake.
Wisconsin has more than 250 lake districts. We'll hear from 2 local leaders of those districts.
First, for more on Wisconsin Lake District laws, we turn to Eric Olson, Director of the Extension Lakes Program at UW-Stevens Point. Eric, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You work with lake organizations all over the state. Can you explain what is a lake district?
A lake district is a special purpose unit of local government, and it's very focused on really taking care of lakes. Often it's just one lake. It can be a chain of lakes, potentially. And the main power of a lake district is to raise money needed to care for that lake. And it could be restoring the lake or it could be protecting it if it's already in good shape.
What would be the difference then between a lake district and a lake association? Is there a distinction?
Sure. Yes, there's a pretty big one. A lake association is just a nonprofit organization, and they're going to raise money through fundraisers and members that pay dues. Their budget really kind of depends on how generous people are and whether people want to join. A lake district is sort of like your school district, where it sets a tax level. And if you're within the lake district, it's not optional. It's compulsory. You're going to be contributing towards that budget.
So are the people who then hold offices in lake districts, are those volunteer capacities? Are those paid positions?
Yeah, it's very much like your school board, I think.
Okay.
Most of them are unpaid. They're volunteers. They can be appointed. There's going to be most Lake District boards will have some people that are appointed to the board and then some that are elected. If the people in that Lake District choose to give a stipend or something to the people that are serving in those boards, they can do that. But I would say most of them do not. It's mostly just volunteer.
And you find that there's the steady growth of lake districts around the state. What is driving communities to create these units of government?
Sure. So a couple of different things. One of them is on lakes that have a dam, and the dam causes the lake levels to rise up. So in Wisconsin, we sometimes call these flowages. Sometimes we just call them impoundments. These dams, as engineered structures, occasionally they need help. They need work. And it could be a minor repair or it could be a major repair, but it's typically pretty expensive. And when people then look at the cost that might be associated with it and they look around at their neighbors and they say, well, we need a mechanism for us to all chip in on this cost. We can't just do it voluntarily. Another one is really the ongoing expenses of both aquatic plant management and dealing with invasive species. Many lakes have Eurasian water milfoil. It's a type of aquatic plant. It can grow very fast and it can limit people's recreational activities. So they either want to do some sort of plant management, and that also can be kind of expensive. If they want to buy a plant harvester, for example, a floating piece of equipment to harvest plants, that could cost north of $100,000. And once again, they want to say, well, if we're all going to benefit from this thing, shouldn't there be a way for us all to chip in? So it solves what an economist would call a free rider problem, where if it's just a lake association, some people say, well, I want to join. I don't need to donate. I'll get the benefit anyway. You know, those people are the free riders. If it's a local government, everybody is chipping in, and so there aren't any free riders.
And there are competing priorities then for these units of government, these lake districts. How do the districts figure out what rises to the top, where they should put their priority?
It's a really interesting kind of form of government because there's the board that we talked about before with the elected and appointed commissioners, but the real rubber hits the road when the Lake District holds an annual meeting. And unlike your school district and your county board, it's the taxpayers themselves who get to determine what the budget is. They get to modify the budget and then they get to vote to approve the budget.
What is the balance of power then between these lake districts and the surrounding county, and what is communication like?
Sure. So another reason why people form lake districts is as a nonprofit lake association, you may not get much attention by the county, or maybe they think of you as just sort of a small group of property owners having picnics. Once you form a lake district, you're a local unit of government as well. And in fact, most lake districts will have a county appointment to the governing board. And that really opens up a pathway for the county and the Lake District to communicate on issues. Remember, the Lake District doesn't have a whole lot of power. Its main power is really just that ability to raise taxes to pay for the programs that they want to be involved in. If they want to do other things, like if they want to regulate recreational activities on the lake, it's actually not the county they work with, but it's the local governments. It could be the town government or multiple town governments. And the town boards would interact with the lake district. And those local governments also have an appointment to the board. So the town or a city or a village will be making an appointment as well.
Eric, is there any body of evidence that finds that these lake districts lead to healthier lakes compared to, you know, bodies of water that have no organized structure around them?
In Wisconsin, there's not a lot of this research that's been done. It's kind of unfortunate. I do know of research in Florida where they have similar lake district structures that has actually shown that the lakes with lake districts carry out more programs and do a better job of taking care of their lakes. Our lakes, you know, if it wasn't for sort of recreational activities and development around the lakes, maybe they could just take care of themselves. But we really have modified the watershed and the shoreline and the lake itself through human activities. And I think it is only through concerted efforts like what lake districts do that we're able to mitigate those harmful impacts. So I do see more groups thinking about, you know, the long term and having a more dependable and stable funding basis to carry out lake restoration projects. And just give you an example, in Dodge County, there are now three fairly large lake districts encompassing the three largest lakes in Dodge County. And they're all collaborating together and working with county government to figure out watershed-based strategies to protect water quality in those lakes. And without a lake district, again, I think they'd be focusing too much time on, you know, holding fundraisers or tracking down sponsors for different events. Whereas now they're able to focus their time and energy on the work itself. What's going to have to happen in order to restore the watershed and reduce the nutrients that are coming into their lakes?
Do you have any advice that you can pass along to people who want to see a positive change on their local lake or to create a district?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing for whatever you want to do is to start talking to other people. Make sure you're not doing anything in isolation. We have well over 600 lake associations and now over 250 lake districts in Wisconsin. On our webpage at Extension Lakes, you'll actually find a directory where you can search by county or lake name and see if there already is a group that exists. We also have an online guide called People of the Lakes. And the first chapter of that guide is really about, you know, how would you get started? Who would you communicate with? And how would you maybe even hold a meeting, assuming you're on a lake that doesn't have any organization at all? Why not get started? And so we're able to answer questions and help people out if they want to get started. It's rare that we would recommend someone jump right into forming a lake district. Instead, we would say, you know, start maybe thinking about an association, talk to your neighbors, find out sort of how much interest there is in helping out, because one person alone or one family or two families aren't going to be able to take care of an entire lake. It really has to be a collective effort.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on. I hope people learn something about lake districts today.
That was Eric Olson, director of the Extension Lakes program at UW-Stevens Point. We're talking about lake districts in Wisconsin, which are bodies of government that provide local power to community members. Joining us now is Lynn Amundson, secretary of the Callahan Mud Lake District in Hayward. Also with us is Tammy Schottsnyder, chairman of Little Green Lake Protection and Rehabilitation District in Green Lake County, Wisconsin. Tammy, starting with you, what is lake life for you and what makes your lake so special?
Little Green Lake is about a 460-acre lake, pretty centrally located in Wisconsin. It is a full recreational lake. Personally, what I enjoy most about it is swimming and boating. However, there are a lot of fishermen. I would say that's probably the most popular activity that occurs on our lake, and some sailing, some paddle sports. So it is really a beautiful, quiet community. It's not a large lake, so there is some camaraderie among neighbors and property owners as well.
And Lynn, you're based in the North Woods on Callahan Lake and Mud Lake. What does the lake community look like there?
Callahan and Mud Lake have been in existence since early the 1930s when it was a logging lake. It is about 600 plus acre lake composed of Mud Lake, Callahan Lake. The North Fork of the Chief River runs through that. We do have a public landing on the north side. We also have two big resorts that allow for launching your boats. Approximately about 140 to 150 houses and cabins now sit amongst the lakes with new development occurring all the time. And our dam sits off of Callahan Lake Road on the south side of the lake.
Tammy, I'm going to go back to you here. How did the Little Green Lake Protection and Rehabilitation District start? What got it off the ground?
The earliest records that we have were really the establishment of a sanitary district that happened in the late 1960s, about 1968. And historically, sanitary districts did exercise some of the lake management activities. However, for about 10 years from in the 70s and 80s, there was a lake association where property owners got together and took some responsibility for the lake management activities. There are challenges. There are, you know, pros and cons of that. Of course, it's an engaged group, but they are volunteers and they are responsible for raising their own funds. In 1984, the Lake District was officially created to replace the sanitary district. And that was done in response to growing concerns about deteriorating water quality. We're a taxing authority, so there is not a need to raise funds like an association would do. We have tax revenue that helps fund the work that we do on the lake, and we are bound to some statutory responsibilities. So it's a little more of a formal governing process than had occurred prior to that time.
But I would imagine that all property owners around the lake have unique opinions and unique perspectives on how tax dollars should be spent. Has that been an issue?
I wouldn't say it's an issue. We're fortunate to have very engaged property owners. We have about 360 Lake District residents, and about 250 of them are riparians. We have an annual meeting, and we usually have at least 100 people that attend. So our district members are interested in having us do, get guidance from them if there's something they'd like us to do differently. So it's not to say that, you know, there's always 100% agreement, but I think we have a lot of good dialogue around what's important.
Lynn, turning back to you, the Callahan Mud Lake Protective Association recently formed the Callahan Mud Lake District. You're the former president. What led the association to become a lake district?
Well, the Callahan Mud Lake Protective Association has existed since around 2007 with volunteer membership, and have always worked very closely with the DNR for any AIS surface water grants and other water issues. September of 2022, after multiple years of DNR inspections of our dam, they again stated in 2022 that the dam is in very poor condition and needs repair. So we brought that to the Callahan Mud Lake Association members and approved through their voting to form what we call the Exploratory Dam Committee. There's been many, many years of question about ownership of the land around the dam. So that is something we needed to explore further. Once that process was approved by the Callahan Mud Lake Association, volunteers joined that committee and have been working on it for over 2.5 years before the whole process took place that we went through to form that lake district.
And so rebuilding the dam infrastructure, that whole issue really brought the attention of how much work there is as part of an association. You know, can you talk a little bit about that transition into a district?
It really was a process, a lot of research into education we received from UW Extension, great, great, knowledgeable people, really becoming very comfortable in learning the Wisconsin Chapter 33 statutes in which the lake districts run under, developing marketing and informational material, doing presentations, developing a website, really looking to be totally transparent and educate all of the property owners and all of those around in our community up here, you know, what it means to be a lake district, what a lake district can do, what are the rules we need to look at, the whole question of ownership, working with Sawyer County and the town around Lake. Now, lake districts up here in Sawyer County, completely a new concept. Although we know there's a couple hundred plus in the state of Wisconsin, this was totally new for everybody. So we took our time developing the proper petition, putting into place a boundary map that we wanted for those boundaries within our Lake District, submitting that to Sawyer County, achieving well over the 51% that's required by the Wisconsin statutes to become a Lake District. And then it went through a couple of different committees at Sawyer County.
Tammy, now that it's summer, though, what are members of the Green Lake District talking about and meeting about and working on?
We've been working on updating our lake management plan. This is typically something that's undertaken about every 5 years, and that involves collecting a lot of data on plants, fish, watershed, identifying what issues might exist, and then partnering with community members and district members to find out what are the goals, what would our residents like to see improved around the lake, and then working with the DNR to get approval on any plans for improvement or restoration activities. We started our partnership with a company called GEI in January. Mm-hmm. They're doing an aquatic plant study right now. And so we're in that data gathering phase. So we're excited to see what they find. And then finally, we are working to have an ordinance passed that would prohibit wake-enhanced boating on our lake. Little Green Lake, I mentioned, is about 460 acres. Its deepest point is 28 feet, but its average depth is 10 feet. Evidence shows that type of boating can be quite damaging, especially in shallow lakes or at depths under 25 feet, which is nearly all of our lake. Our lake sits within two municipalities, the city of Marquesan and the town of Green Lake, and we're working with both of those municipalities to pass matching ordinances.
Lynn, before we go, do you foresee a need for wake ordinances on Callahan and Mud Lakes?
I don't believe so at this time. Our main concern, one thing I do want to mention, is that our lake association will stay in existence at least through 2026. Because the DNR's AIS surface water grant that was awarded to us in February goes to the Lake Association. So our ongoing concern for water quality, EWN management, bat aquatic species management will be held within the Lake Association, even though they work very closely with what will transfer over to the Lake District after 2026. Right now, we have no plans and no discussion to talk about wakeboarding or other major big projects. The focus right now is to work with the county and the town about being able to see what we can do to reconstruct or rebuild the dam and go from there.
Well, Lynn and Tammy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is Tammy Schott-Snyder, chairman of Little Green Lake Protection and Rehabilitation District, and Lynn Amundson, secretary of the Callahan Mud Lake Protective Association in Hayward. Earlier, we spoke with Eric Olson, director of the Extension Lakes Program at UW-Stevens Point.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a Wisconsin woman became the first person to climb the biggest mountain on each continent after a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. She shares the inspiration she got from her father.
He was such an inspiration to everyone there to just keep going and do it for the love of following a dream and having a goal.
That's next on Wisconsin Today.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Bridget Bowden with a story about a beloved and mysterious sweet treat. It's part of WPR's Wisconsin Road Trip series, which features pit stops around the state to explore some of the people, places, and things that make Wisconsin summers special.
Blue Moon ice cream is a staple at roadside shops throughout the Upper Midwest. But where did this Smurf-colored treat come from, and what explains its long-standing appeal? WPR's Sarah Lear brings us the scoop from an ice cream shop in Columbus.
It's a busy day at the Sassy Cow Creamery, as machines bottle milk and freezers hum. Out front, there's an ice cream counter with rows and rows of flavors. One that stands out is a tub of vivid blue. That's the one that many kids point to, says Christina Lee, an ice cream maker at the Sassy Cow.
They run up and they don't even know the name. They just, I want the blue one.
Blue Moon ice cream is sold almost exclusively in the Midwest. It's especially popular in Wisconsin and Michigan. Both states are rumored to have invented the flavor. But exactly what that flavor is can be hard to define. We asked some Wisconsinites to give it a try.
When I worked at an ice cream shop, we described it as either almond or citrus and spice.
It tastes just like Fruit Loops. Yeah, it really does, yeah.
It's like cereal milk, frozen.
It's like really sweet, kind of like a marshmallow.
That was Callie Edelmeyer of Teresa, Tim Dirth of Grafton, Dylan Neaton of Sun Prairie, and Lauren Bunn of Fenimore. They all came to enjoy ice cream on a sunny Wisconsin day at the Sassy Cow. Meanwhile, Lee was at work in the creamery's back room, making a batch of Blue Moon. Cream and sugar are blended with milk that comes from cows that graze at farms near the shop. Lee adds a small amount of dark blue flavoring to a big metal machine.
And spin my machine, which essentially I just have two bars that kind of rotate in there, scraping the sides. I also have my freezing over here that tells it when it should get really, really cold and when it shouldn't.
Lisa's Blue Moon is one of the Sassy Cow's top sellers. But the true origins of the greenish-blue dessert may never be unthawed. Early 20th century newspaper articles make mention of something called Blue Moon ice cream in states as far-flung as New Jersey and Ohio. It's not clear, though, whether any of those shops were selling a flavor that's akin to the Blue Moon of today. There is some evidence, however, that the beloved flavor could have started with the Wisconsin business. Decades ago, an Illinois-based company known as Weber Flavors bought a Milwaukee-based company called Patron Products. Documents show Patron Products of Wisconsin filed to trademark the Blue Moon flavor in the 1970s. At the time, Patron claimed it had been using the term Blue Moon since at least 1939. Today, Weber holds the trademark for Blue Moon. That means it has exclusive rights to use the term for ice cream flavoring. It sells the flavoring to more than 100 retailers across the country, including the Sassy Cow. Melissa Healy is a marketing manager at Weber Flavors. She says Blue Moon sees the highest demand in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Illinois. But the company does sell the flavor to shops that are farther afield.
A little bit of Ohio and a little bit of like the kind of Iowa, Minnesota area. And then we have some kind of random like Arizona, Alabama customers.
These days, many people are wary of artificial colors in food. So Weber Products sells the Blue Moon flavor both with and without the signature cyan coloring. The one with added color is way more popular. Back at the Sassy Cow Creamery, 3-year-old Kata Kors is drawn to vibrant shades.
Do you have a favorite color?
I like blue.
Kata lives in California, but she's visiting her grandparents in Wisconsin. She chooses Blue Moon with sprinkles.
What do you think about it? How does it taste?
Good.
Then she smiles, revealing lips and teeth that are stained bright blue.
WPR's Sarah Lear brought us that story on Blue Moon ice cream. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Bridget Bowden.
Join us every Friday this summer for more Wisconsin road trips. To see all the stops and plan your own road trip, find the series page at wpr.org/roadtrip.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Lori Schneider has had a remarkable life. Born and raised in Janesville, she climbed the seven summits, which are the highest mountains on each of the seven continents.
It's a massive accomplishment for any mountaineer, but Schneider achieved it with a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. She's the first person with MS to climb the seven summits and the first person with MS to hit the summit of Everest.
Schneider says her mountaineering career wasn't actually her idea. It was her dad's. She climbed the first summit with her father, Neil Schneider. They reached the peak of Mount Kilimanjaro on his 61st birthday.
For this Father's Day, Lori Schneider tells us how her dad inspired her and how she passed that inspiration along to others by founding the organization Empowerment Through Adventure. Lori, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure for me to be able to chat with you about my wonderful dad today.
And your dad, I understand, was your inspiration. You started mountaineering because of him. Can you tell us how that journey began?
Well, my dad had always been athletic, and he was a runner. And back when I was in high school, we used to go out for 5 a.m. runs every once in a while and get exercise. And one day he came home and said he'd listened to a speaker at a local service club in Janesville who was talking about climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. And Dad said, you know, someday I'd love to do that. And of course, I adored my dad. And I said, well, someday I'll go with you, Dad. And it took about 20 years of life progressing for both of us. So back in 1993, I was going to be in Africa for part of the summer, and we planned to meet there and climb Mount Kilimanjaro together. It was the first time for me to climb, really, other than hiking in Colorado. and the first time for my dad ever to do any mountaineering. It took a long time, but we did. We reached the summit on Dad's 61st birthday. He was such an inspiration to me, but it was funny because it was so difficult, much more difficult than we thought, to do that climb that was about a week long. And I remember linking arm in arm right before the summit, and Dad looked at me and said, "I don't know if I can make it." And I said, "I don't know if I can make it either." And we literally joined arms and kind of dragged each other to the summit.
Now, I've never climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. If I did, I would think, okay, that was an achievement of a lifetime there. You didn't stop there, though. This is one of the seven summits, the highest mountains on each continent, and you wanted to keep going. What led from Kilimanjaro to the rest of the mountains?
Well, actually, it was my dad's idea to keep going. It was about 7 years later, you know, now he's 68 years old, and I was teaching in Colorado, and he called me up one day and he said, "I think we should do another climb."
Wow.
"But this time it has to be harder." And I kind of laughed. I said, "Dad, do you remember we hardly made the last one?" And he said, "No, we're going to train really hard. Let's train for another year and try to do another of the seven summits." So we set our sights on Mount Aconcagua, the highest peak in South America. But the problem was, right when we had decided to do this climb, I woke up one morning numb on one side of my body and was later diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. So Dad's now worried about taking his daughter with multiple sclerosis to South America to try another mountain climb. And I was worried about taking my 68-year-old father there, you know. So it was tough, but we trained very, very hard, and we went there, and Dad ended up getting altitude sickness at around 18,000 feet, and he had to turn around. We sent him back down with a porter, but gosh, I remember him looking at me and saying, "Lori, you've got to do this, and you know why." And I said, I know. And he said, "You have to prove to yourself that you're mentally stronger than this disease." He said, "It can take things from your body, but don't let it take your will to live and follow your dreams." And so I get choked up even thinking about it. And he went down with a guide, and I followed another guide up for the next couple of days and summited the mountain and came back down, and we were so excited to be together again. But and I had to laugh because Dad said, "You keep climbing the seven summits, but my next one is going to be Space Mountain in Disney World." So that was his last official summit for a number of years. So
we're talking to Lori Schneider, a mountaineer born and raised in Wisconsin. She's climbed the tallest mountain on every continent, the first person with MS to summit Everest. For this Father's Day, Schneider's telling us how her dad inspired her throughout her life. Lori, you keep going for the rest of the seven summits. You have MS. Can you talk about what a challenge that added? I mean, I couldn't have climbed any of these mountains without MS. How much of an added hurdle is that?
For me, it was very, very difficult at first because MS, multiple sclerosis, often causes real issues with balance. So my mobility was in question because I was a little wonky at times, balance-wise. So, you know, I had that symptom, and I also had a lot of numbness in my fingers and toes, which are symptoms that can also happen when you're at altitude. So for me, those were things I had to work hard to overcome in some ways. And I worked with a trainer who helped me do a lot of balance training and core strengthening. But, you know, the other part was, I think I've become mentally stronger because of the MS, because it's about believing in yourself and giving yourself the right to go out and try something regardless of what the outcome is. I don't set out to summit a mountain. I set out to give it my best shot and try. But I got to tell you, Rob, I'm one of the lucky ones with this disease because so many people have a very difficult time, you know, even walking up a flight of stairs, let alone climbing a mountain. And I was lucky, very lucky.
And Laura, you're very clear about that on the website. Not everybody with MS is going to be able to climb mountains. And I think that's part of the inspiration. I understand your dad is part of the inspiration, too, for founding Empowerment Through Adventure. Can you talk about what inspired you to do this and what you set out to do?
So when I finished climbing the seven summits, you know, Dad said to me one day, well, what do you want to do next? And I said, what I'd like to do with your help, Dad, is to encourage others who live with disabilities to find that empowerment that I found through climbing. And so the year after I climbed Everest, Dad helped me organize a trip to go back to Africa to climb Kilimanjaro. And we brought a group of 10 people with multiple sclerosis, 4 people with Parkinson's disease, and then a lot of medical personnel and support personnel. And honestly, Dad was the inspiration in that group. He never gave up. He kept marching along, you know, and at 78, that's a tough thing to do. And he did get altitude sickness once again at, oh gosh, probably 18, 19,000 feet and had to turn around. But he was such an inspiration to everyone there to just keep going and do it for the love of following a dream and having a goal.
And finally, what goes through your mind on Father's Day weekend?
My father passed away in October, and I miss him terribly, but I am so grateful for all of the things he's taught me along the way and all of the experiences we've been so lucky to have together as father and daughter. And he not only was my father, but he was a dear, dear friend, and he'll be in my heart forever.
And I'm so glad I got to meet him through your stories, Lori. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the chance to share about my dad. I love him dearly.
Lori Snyder is a mountaineer, motivational speaker, and founder of the organization Empowerment Through Adventure. She grew up in Janesville, and she's the first person with multiple sclerosis to reach the highest summit on each continent. She shared the inspiration she got from her late father, Neil. WPR's Road Trip Project is sharing recommendations of fun stuff to do in Wisconsin this summer. You can follow along at WPR.org/roadtrip.
Last week we featured indie bookstores, got a big response on our Instagram feed. A
couple posts had suggestions from all over. One quote, it's so hard to pick one I enjoy. Blue House Books in Kenosha, Reads by the River Books in Waterford, Boswell Books in Milwaukee, Wonderland Bookshop in Shorewood, and most recently Novel Bay Booksellers in Sturgeon Bay.
Another listener recommends Bound to Happen Books in Stevens Point, The Story Seller in Wausau, Arcadia Books in Spring Green, and Room of One's Own in Madison.
Other suggestions, Epilogue Books in Menominee Falls,
Burrell Street Books in La Crosse,
Yonkey Bookstore in Wausau,
Honest Dog Books in Bayfield,
The Book Deal in Madison,
Lion's Mouth Bookstore in Green Bay,
KG's Unique Rare and Antique Books in Marshfield,
and Peninsula Bookman in Fish Creek.
Did you miss your favorite on that list? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Phew. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Courtney Everett, and Colleen Leahy.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
The managing producer is Tim Peterson, and Dean Kinetter is executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.